boys. It takes heavy, heavy sack to sign up for this contest. You've all got it. You're men now. As you all know, our country has been in a period of financial struggle since the war. And we did the first long walk all those years ago to inspire and reintegrate the value of work ethic. Each year after the event, there's a spike in production. We have the means to return to our former glory. Our problem now is an epidemic of laziness. You boys are the answer. The long walk is the answer.
Welcome to this Three Men in a Retrospective podcast review of The Long Walk, part of the Percolated Media Stephen King Retrospective Series.
Come on, boy. We're right on pace. Come on.
Join participants Garrett.
My dad was my hero.
Matt.
A short friendship is better than no friendship, right?
That's what I've been saying,
That's
man.
That's what I'm been saying.
And Adam.
You've been a hell of a fucking friend.
As they review this long in development adaptation of the popular author's first finished novel.
I'm writing a book, you see?
And keep coming back as the co-hosts continue going through each of King's cinematic adaptations in publication order.
You want to know how I know so much about The Long Walk?
So get ready to have your tickets punched, Percolated Media listeners.
Give him his wish.
The Three Men in a Retrospective's review of The Long Walk begins now.
Look, son.
The Long Walk, released September 12, 2025. Budget on this was $20 million, box office $49 million, and this is directed by Francis Lawrence. Oh my god, The Long Walk. You talk about a long journey getting to the screen. That's what this movie went through. First of all, this book is Stephen King's first finished novel. He started it in high school, finished it right around his freshman year in college. And when it came out that Richard Bachman, which is how this book was released, it was released in the Richard Bachman collection that I have that has The Running Man in it. When it came out that this was Stephen King, they have tried getting this made since 1988. And I'll get to all the background of that when I get to it. But Matt, before you saw this movie, how familiar were you with The Long Walk?
I was not even aware of its existence. I didn't even know this thing was coming out until I saw a trailer before something. So we also had to clear up or send a reminder as far as how we're doing this retrospective, because we're going, just to make this clear to everyone, we're doing this in order of the release of the novels, which is why, because we've had multiple Stephen King movies this year that have predated this, which is why we haven't covered them yet. So just, I wanted to put that out there and remind everyone. I've had people ask me, how come you didn't do The Monkey, and how come you didn't do Life of Chuck? Well, it's because in his bibliography, we haven't gotten there yet, even though the movies predate this. But as far as my association with this, I know nothing about the book. I haven't read it. Didn't know it was a thing. Because in my mind, I think like Carrie, Salem's Lot, The Shining, early on, I totally forgot this is in that assortment.
And Adam, I'm assuming you had no idea this was even a Stephen King property until they announced it, right?
I had no idea. In fact, I rolled my eyes at Long Walk, Running Man. Oh, come on. Like, and I know, you know, of the Bachman books. I know all that stuff. I mean, in fact, the way that I follow his son the same way, who used a pseudonym at first. So I wasn't against it. But yeah, I had no idea. I didn't know about it till I saw it was on our schedule. And then I saw a trailer. And yeah, that was the only thing I really knew about it.
Okay, well, the public didn't really know anything about it until it was released in September. But in order to get it released, we had to go through quite a trek. Now, in 1988, it was a gentleman that we're going to be talking a lot about. And in fact, I think next year we're going to be talking about projects that Stephen King did with George A. Romero. But at this point, he was attached to do a version of The Long Walk. But that never really came to fruition. Matt, how do you think George A. Romero, Long Walk, late 80s, how do you think that would have worked?
Well, I can only judge it based on the movie I've just seen. And putting myself, taking this book, or at least the movie I just saw, and putting it in Romero's hands, I don't know how that would have played, because he built his reputation on the zombie genre. And this really is not that. The Long Walk describes how he feels about how zombies should move, because he was notorious for hating running zombies, ironically. So I kind of like that mission statement, but I also don't care for a lot of his non-dead movies. So I don't know how it would have translated. I think based in the late 80s and what he did with some movies we'll talk about down the road, this kind of screamed an 88. This would have been like the perfect thing for like a Rob Reiner or a Frank Darabont, you know, the guys who've done King properties before. And I bring them up just because, you know, King will work with Romero. You know, he did Creepshow and one or two others.
Dark Half.
So of all those guys, like recurring collaborators, I don't think Romero would have been the best fit for this material based on the movie. And from my understanding, and Garrett, I'm sure we'll talk about this, there are a lot of changes compared to the book. I don't know what they are. I just know by osmosis that this is not a literal translation.
Yeah, it kind of is for the most part. I mean, there's dialogue lifted directly from the book. There are some changes that I will go over when we get to them, but to make this a literal translation, I reread The Long Walk about a month before the movie was released, and I like the book. However, it is written by somebody who was kind of immature. At one point, somebody sees a chick and he gets hard and he's jerking off as he's walking. He's having fantasies of girls as he's walking. Things like that. That is a good idea to omit from the feature adaptation. But by 2007, a gentleman that you just mentioned, Matt, Frank Darabont, who has quite the reputation of adapting Stephen King like Rob Reiner and doing it well. We'll talk about his adaptations. We'll get to The Green Mile. We will get to The Mist. He had gathered up the rights right when The Mist was released, and he was determined to get this made. And I remember an interview as late as 2017 where Darabont was talking about his vision for this, and he was saying that he was going to have GoPros attached to the walkers so that you have a POV of the walkers as they walk. Matt, do you think that would have worked?
I can at least see Darabont with this material more than I can Romero. I don't know. The GoPro idea just sounds like a gimmick. If you're going to do that, you might as well turn this into like a crank where you put heart monitors on them. And if they fall below, like you set off a bomb like the Suicide Squad, if you needed to add that extra oomph rather than just having them get shot. But I certainly could have seen Darabont, especially around, let's see, 07. I think The Mist was right around that time. Mm-hmm. So he was knees deep in King. And I think he would have fit the material. So I'm honestly surprised this didn't happen sooner.
I definitely am. Adam, as somebody who just watched this movie, how do you think that gimmick would have worked, putting GoPros on the walkers as they walk?
I think you could have edited it in. I think you could have some of it just to get that view, but in a movie that way, God, no, absolutely not. Nothing more than a short. But on occasion, seeing that kind of point of view with the camera bouncing around, sure, why not?
Let me also ask, because I don't know, how big is this book? Are we talking something that's reputable length, or is this like It or The Stand where you can bludgeon someone to death?
No. It is in that volume of books. It contains four stories. It has Rage, which is the story we talked about where a kid holds up his school. There's The Running Man. There's a story called Road Work, which is pretty much a guy just getting angry that his house is being built over and takes it out on the city. And
so is Pixar's Up basically on that statement?
Yeah, a less angry edition probably. And there's this, and this is probably about 180 or so pages, not that long. This is not King at his most self-indulgent. Like I said, it was his first finished novel, so it's not that hard of a read at all. So Darabont kept saying, I'm going to get to it one day. And he was saying that he was going to make it low budget. You know, I'm going to make it very self-contained. I'm not going to slick it up at all. It's going to be a very raw adaptation. But he let go of the rights. And then New Line Cinema picks it up. And a gentleman that we'll be talking about eventually, a guy by the name of James Vanderbilt, who wrote the Amazing Spider-Man films, amongst other things, he was attached to write and produce it, and Andre Overdahl was going to direct it. Andre Overdahl, he did The Last Voyage of Demeter just a few years ago. Matt, Andre Overdahl, James Vanderbilt, how would that look?
Would not have had much confidence in it. They're certainly not as established as Romero or Darabont or pick somebody. And having seen a lot of what Vanderbilt's written, think outside of Zodiac, which I attribute a lot of that to David Fincher, not a whole lot of hits on that resume. I mean, I also can't give him a lot of credit for what I like about the more recent Scream films, because those movies are written by multiple people.
Oh, did he write those?
I don't think he was the sole writer. No, he's a co-writer on 5 and he's a co-writer on 6. Okay. So I like those more than most, but it's kind of hard to assign credit. As far as the Andre, you know, Andre the Giant would have given me more confidence than that other guy named Andre.
So it looked at this point that this book had been circulating for 30 years. Not even getting made. And I didn't think it would ever get made. I remember really, as a teenager, I didn't really like the book. But on my reread, I did really like it. And I thought there were some great possibilities. So color me surprised when in November of 2023, they attach a gentleman that, guys, we have talked a lot about on this particular podcast. A guy who's kind of attached himself to the Hunger Games franchise. A guy by the name of Francis Lawrence. We'll eventually get to Constantine as well. He comes on board with a screenplay by J.T. Mulner. Now, Matt, did you watch Strange Darlings?
Yeah, and I loved it.
Did you really? See, I thought it was okay. I couldn't really get into the gimmick of it. I thought it was trying too hard to be like a Memento kind of thing. It was okay. But I will say this. I thought the twist that they had in it was brilliant. Adam, are you familiar with J.T. Mulner? Did you see Strange Darlings?
No. Looking at his filmography as a writer, I'm not familiar with anything he's done.
Look, check out Strange Darlings. I'd be anxious to hear your thoughts on that. So he gets attached. He's writing the screenplay. Big fan of the book. Big fan of King himself. And speaking of King, he was involved in this as well. In fact, in the book, the miles per hour they are walking is 4 miles an hour. Which, if you try doing that on a treadmill, good luck.
Yes, but I will say that is one of the most ingenious ploys to get people to see a movie that I can recall. Like, William Castle would be proud of that gimmick.
We'll talk about the promotion here in a bit, but in the book it was 4 miles per hour, and King is the one who changed it. He's like, look, if we're going to do this, let's put it down to 3 miles an hour, which more manageable.
I like that the reason is that when he wrote the book, he didn't really realize how fast 4 miles an hour was. He just thought it sounded
right. He just kind of said off the top of his head.
I mean, the average walking pace is 2.5.
Yeah, like when you hit 4 miles an hour, that's like a brisk, almost like a very light jog.
Yeah.
Even the kids that are D1 football players wouldn't be able to keep that up. So I think that was actually a smart change.
I do too. And King also had, at this point, he's got a lot of power. He has approval on cast. He has approval on director, writer. He had to approve the script. There's a big change in the script that he had to approve, which I can't wait to talk about because I honestly am shocked that he actually allowed it. But the cast is on board. The budget, $20 million. Not much for a budget in 2025. They also have Mark Hamill here as the main villain. So, Matt, you had zero confidence in Andre Overdahl. How'd you feel as stuff about this was leaking out as to what they were going to be making here?
Well, I wasn't happy with the Francis Lawrence hire because this struck me as the equivalent of stunt casting, where, of course, you get the guy who made the majority of the Hunger Games movies in a movie that is very similar to that concept in a lot of ways. I mean, look, the story predates the Hunger Games books, but I've seen this on surface level. It did not instill a lot of confidence in me that this was going to be like a refreshing approach to this. If anything, I was worried it was going to be derivative and all too similar to the Hunger Games, which I like some of those movies considerably more than others, but I wasn't utterly confident in Lawrence being director. He's not a bad director by any means, but I didn't think it was a inspirational hire.
And of course, the third on this podcast, Adam, I think he just loves to rile me up because he starts sending fucking articles in our little chat group about people saying that King ripped off the Hunger Games with this story. When in fact, yes, this does predate the Hunger Games. This predates Battle Royale. The writer and director of Battle Royale has come out and said when he read The Long Walk, he wanted to make something similar to that, which is why he came up with Battle Royale. This has more reach than people realize.
I'm also just sick of, for the record also, sorry to cut you off, Adam, I'm just sick of this type of story because we're kind of getting, ever since Battle Royale, we've gotten an influx of these, you know, ride or die type of game show, you know, dystopian futures, Hunger Games, Battle Royale, like Squid Game, whatever Mr. Beast does on Amazon. Like, it's just kind of, I don't know how much, pardon the pun, how much more mileage you can get out of this concept when I was walking into the theater.
Well, they're doing a Lord of the Flies TV series, so it's not.
Oh, geez, are they?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, hell, even The Running Man, which we're getting next month. God, we're having 4 Stephen King movies this year. That's got to be the most we've had
in a while,
in a single year, in a long time.
When I first started seeing the marketing for this, I didn't pay attention to who directed it. I just didn't. So that it was Francis Lawrence completely went over my head. And it wasn't until about a week before that I was, you know, starting to get pre-notes, things like that, getting together. And I was like, Francis Lawrence. And it still took me a second. I was like, clicked on him. And my eyes rolled so far back in my head, I left them in mile three. Like, it just seemed. I mean, we'll discuss how I feel about it as we get into it. But that felt like the most stunt-casted possible thing you could absolutely do for this kind of film on page and on marketing. It's just, I don't know who watched The Hunger Games that is going to follow Francis Lawrence over, but that's kind of what it feels like they were hoping for.
It does feel like that. And apparently the answer to that's not many, because this has made not even $50 million.
Made more than The Shining.
Yeah, it did.
It's made more than like 2/3 of his work. But he's got a $1 billion film only a few years ago.
Yeah, right.
I think there are reasons. For one thing, I don't think this was marketed particularly well or had that as much of an outreach. Stephen King's name doesn't automatically put butts in seats like it used to. And it's hard to talk about this movie without getting political to some degree. But seeing a movie about a totalitarian regime and a dystopian future, you go to movies for escapism, not for reflections of reality. And I don't think this, in the climate we're living in now, is the most uplifting thing to go see. Now, granted, this story is not an uplifter by any stretch of the imagination, but I don't think this is the right thing to go see if you want an uplifter.
Summer movie.
This was written by a very angry young man who was scared of getting drafted to war. And
Donald Trump? Oh.
Good one. And I think you see that reflected in this story. I think you're seeing these people bond like you would in war. Things like that. I'll talk about it. It goes deeper than I think the surface level would announce it to be. But you're absolutely right. I don't think this was the right time. But then again, what is the right time to release something like this? Because it's not exactly uplifting.
No. And I think to Matt's point about the marketing, it's difficult to do. But I think they failed by not getting press screenings and not getting some of that out a week, 2 weeks, 4 weeks in advance. Sometimes you get that build before release, because it seemed like after opening week, the press was great. And I think that's why it had some legs. But I think if you could have done it before opening weekend, I think you could have still had a different result.
Well, let's talk about one aspect of the marketing that they did, which was just crazy to me that they came up with this. I think it's kind of genius, actually. They got critics to come to a screening that's filled with treadmills. And the movie's on as the treadmill's going. And if you get off the treadmill, or if you go below 3 miles an hour, you're out of the screening. You cannot watch the movie anymore.
Yeah, you didn't go to a different room and finish it. You missed out on how it ended.
Exactly. You could not see it. Which, Adam, how do you think that marketing is?
I wish they would have done it somewhere here. I would have done it for the absolute ridiculous factor of it. And I might have been upset trying to not spill my popcorn and icy while I'm walking 3 miles an hour nonstop. But I absolutely, like, that is a stunt that I think is well done. Like, I'm just, bravo.
Yeah, that is something the Alamo Draft House would be proud of as far as promotional work, because that's the kind of thing that they would do. And I mentioned William Castle, who was the master of theater gimmicks. I have to applaud whoever came up with that. And all things considered, it's the best promotion this movie's gotten, because despite getting very strong word of mouth, it's kind of came and went.
All right, let's talk about theatrical experiences, which I know at least 2 of the 3 of us have some pretty crazy ones. Adam, let's go to you first. You saw this, 2 weeks after it was already out?
Yeah, I think it was 2 weeks after. I think it was middle of the 3rd week that it was. And I wanted to see it the weekend before and something happened. But yeah, I just went middle of the day, Wednesday, I think, Wednesday or Thursday. Shoot, I want to say like 3:30 in the afternoon. So about as empty as you could possibly think a theater would be. And I was in there with about 30, because when I bought my tickets a few days before, it was fixing to be a private screening. But by the time I got there, yeah, about 30 people in there.
Wow.
Mostly, I would say, over 30. We had a couple older people in there. So this isn't a young people's movie. I don't think it's meant to be. And yeah, I mean, all in all, it was a pretty damn good experience. It was one of the better theater experiences I've been able to have in quite a while. So here's to the old people going out and respecting a theater experience.
Wow. All right. Matt, you want to go first on this?
Yeah, I wish I saw it with that crowd, because I went to go see this in the atmosphere of a sports book in Vegas, because there was so much talking. You'd think people were betting on the actual contestants and thinking this was a documentary. Oh my God, I was so infuriated. And just because it's a long walk, people thought they could take their shoes off in the theater, which drives me up the fucking wall no matter how many times gross. It happened.
I hate those people.
So between the two of those things, yeah, I was real fucking peachy watching this. I almost turned into Mark Hamill in this movie and just started yelling at people.
With your Ray-Bans on? Oh, man.
Apparently, for the record, that shows how little I was paying attention to the theaters. I did not realize that was Mark Hamill in the trailers.
Yeah, I don't think anybody did, really. The only reason I knew is because I saw the announcement. Oh, man. I want to talk about my long journey, long walk in seeing this fucking movie. So I go online, I buy tickets for September 16th, and me and Jen, we had it all set. Jen was going to get off work early. We were going to go see the movie. And first of all, I got tickets for 4 o'clock. And I had thought that I got tickets for 3 o'clock. So when 2:30 rolls around, she's not home yet, I'm screaming at her like, where are you? Where are you? We're supposed to go to the movie. She's like, no, it's not till 4. Yes, it's at 3. So there's the one mix-up. Most weird theatrical experiences would end there. And we just go to the movie and everything would be okay. No, I check and it's like, oh shit, it's 4 o'clock. You're right. So she gets here. We drive over to the theater. And we ordered stuff ahead of time, and we're set to pick it up. We go over to pick up our stuff. It's not there. And I'm looking at the manager. She's like, yeah, give me the order number. I said, well, here it is. I have $28 worth of stuff. I swear to God, I paid for it. Here's my receipt for it. She gets it for us. She's like, okay, it must be a mix-up. So here's your stuff. And I'm like, okay, well, we left an hour ahead of time. By this point, we had about 15 minutes left before the movie starts. We go to sit down. And we check our seat numbers. There are 2 people in our seats. Look, I'm like, wait a second here. I show the guy. I said, yeah, I don't know if we bought these at the same time, but these are our seats. He's like, well, we were here first. To their credit, they were so nice. He was just like, I don't know what happened, man. It must be a mix-up. I'm like, God damn it. So I have all the popcorn, all the stuff that we had bought. I go back up to the manager, and I take it up, and we had gotten our tickets and everything. She looks. And she points at the ticket, and I look, and guys, I didn't buy tickets for the 16th. I bought tickets for the 17th of September. So I'm like, what the fuck? So me and Chan just take our stuff, and I felt bad. I had like all this stuff that we had bought and everything, and I threw this stuff away, and I'm like, I'm not going to eat any of this stuff. We're just going to come back tomorrow. And the people in the seats, bless their hearts, they're like, look, nobody's sitting next to us. You guys can go ahead and sit next to us if you guys want. We're fine. I said, we're like, you know what, man, thanks, but we're going to go ahead and come back tomorrow. So he came back the next day, and I was in a piss-poor mood when I left, and then when I got there the next day, I was still in a piss-poor mood when the movie started, but that was the long journey it was to see the movie, and that was quite the experience.
Jesus. You know what? God bless Jen. I mean, we knew she was a saint already, but wow. Now she's got to check the time and date on you.
I know!
I was going to say, I thought with the way that story was going, we're going to have to call you Karen Collins from now on.
And that manager of that theater, God bless her, she saw us the next day. I looked at her. I said, hey, look, we're here on the right day. And she laughed, and she's like, is there anything else you guys need? We're like, no, we're fine. We already got our stuff. She offered to even comp the freaking stuff that day just because of my stupid-ass mix-up. But, oh, yeah.
I will say, when I bought my tickets, like I said, they were, you know, it was a private screening, so I bought one ticket. I went by myself. Nobody around me. When I go down to sit my seat, fucking 3 friends had bought the seats right next to me.
I hate that.
And there was so many empty seats. I ended up moving my seat. But I'm like, who the hell does this? Like,
that place is already taken. So we're just going to take the ones right next to it instead of taking
right next
ones,
to me.
Yeah. Oh.
Yep. Yeah. Oh.
All right. So we open up. We're seeing a letter of acceptance to Ray Garrity as we are now on to the 19th anniversary of the war that tore this world apart. Now,
wow, this is really familiar to me right away.
Right?
Does this take place in Penham?
No. Can't wait for the 20th quarter quell.
The book does not specify any war or anything. This was added by Molnar himself.
Oh.
Just to kind of give a little bit of a background as all we're doing here. But I like seeing this letter, though. I think it's a good way to start things off. We don't really know where we're going. That's the weird thing about the long walk. We don't know what the long walk is.
The thing, this explains what you need to know pretty much right off the bat. Like, this is shorthand that to me was very effective. I watched the initial teaser and that was it. I didn't want to know anything else. This got the job done. I understood exactly from here. I mean, obviously there's rules and stuff like that we get, but this did the job. And I was like, okay, I get it. Let's go.
I was equally impressed because I was thinking of the first Hunger Games movie where it starts with a wall of text giving all the background about the rebellion and the districts and all that. So I was thoroughly encouraged to get the basics of both the state of the world, but also the kind of like indoctrination effect that the Long Walk has in itself on not just the participants, but the world as a whole, that some people take getting this as a badge of honor, I thought was a fun way. And right away, I'm getting, as this whole movie is, a lot of Vietnam allegations and connections too.
Yeah, I mean, as people who listen to this podcast know, I am usually just a staunch hater of text on screen to start things off. But I think for this particular movie, for this movie that we don't know what we're going into, I think it works well. So we're seeing Ray being driven by his mom, Judy Greer, making another appearance on the 3 Minute Retrospective podcast this year.
This woman has played more moms in movies than a tab on Pornhub. I mean, if you need a mom in a film, you call Judy Greer.
Apparently. What I like about this is, again, we don't know what this walk consists of, and they're going to keep that a secret for a while. So this drive really has an air of dread.
Yeah, especially because their conversation is split like a political debate. She's kind of as apprehensive as you can be about doing this, and then he's kind of very, like, I don't want to say laissez-faire, but he's looking at this as a positive. So I like that in a world that's kind of been savaged by war, you're still getting a mixed response.
Now, Ray Garrity is played by Cooper Hoffman. And as I was watching this movie, I'm like, God, that kid looks so familiar. I had no idea who he was, but he looks familiar. And then when I saw it was Philip Seymour Hoffman's kid, it blew me away. I don't think this movie has a point of view character, but I think this would be the closest to a point of view character we have. I think Cooper Hoffman's good. I think the way he's like not exactly fit to walk like this, like he's not exactly a dude who's completely in shape. I think it works for this character, and I think this character is very good.
Thoroughly impressed, because I did not like him in Licorice Pizza at all. And I kind of have a certain upkeep against Nepo babies, especially ones that are, you know, the sons or daughters of great actors, which he is. I was thoroughly impressed by him in this. He is as much of a POV character as you can have for 95% of this movie. And I think he does a good job, which is impressive considering a lot of King protagonists I find to be just very flat and not a whole lot on the page. But there's more to him than just the performance, which I appreciated. I did not have a Michael Gandolfini situation where I'm sitting there going, this kid's only here because of who his dad is.
He did say he brought a lot of the fact that he lost his dad at an early age to this role. And I think it shows. I think he's very good.
Yeah, I think he does a really good job. To your point with Gandolfini's kid, it's amazing how they look similar, but this one actually has some acting ability. The losing his father and then playing a role in this where the father lost, like that wasn't lost on me. I was glad I didn't know who he was ahead of time, because I think I would have been prejudiced by that. But I think he does a dang good job. He's not the only person that I've seen in other films that I didn't recognize, but I think it's a good cast. I don't think he was cast because of the late, great Hoffman, but I think it's a good choice to go with him.
I hated, for the record, knowing who he was, because whenever someone holds a gun up to one of these kids, all I see is his dad in the opening of Mission Impossible 3.
Oh, shit. Ray is let out as he grabs his bag, and his mom gives him some oatmeal chocolate chip bars. They exchange I love yous, and his mom loses it as he leaves.
I'm going to say it here. Judy Greer is impressive. I have never thought of her as an actress other than perfunctory in so many things. She brought something here that I didn't think was possible. I'll give her credit for that. And it starts here at the very beginning.
I've always liked her. I'm just tired of her getting these thankless roles.
I know.
Yes.
We just talked about Jurassic World. Yeah. And this, you're right, Adam. This looks like he's going to war, and she's losing it because her son is going to war. I agree with you. I think she's tremendous. And I'm not a huge Judy Greer fan myself.
All I hear is Cheryl. I try my damnedest every time, but that's just where my brain goes.
Yeah, I haven't watched Archer in a while, but now that you mention it. She holds the embrace as he once again says, I love you, and leaves. We see Pete in the background. We meet David Johnson's Pete as they go to the group and sit down. Guys, we talked about this guy when we talked about Alien Romulus last year. He made an impression on me then, and I gotta say, he makes just as equal an impression on me on this film. I think he's tremendous.
This was one of the other faces that I'm like, it bugs me so much that I know him. It bugs me so much that I know him, and I forgot about Romulus. He was good in that. I think he brings something greater to this role. I think it's a really well cast. I don't know how the book was written race wise, but I'm really glad I didn't have to deal with people bitching and moaning about race swaps and, you know, a book that nobody read. So, you know, in movies nowadays, I think he's amazingly well cast, and other than looking like he's got Chris Pratt's bottom lip with some chaw in the entire time, I think he's pretty fucking great in this film. Like, it's goddamn, I can't wait to see what this guy keeps doing.
I have the answer to your question later, but I'm going to go ahead and say it right now. The book is written by somebody who grew up in Maine, which is an all-white state pretty much, and everybody in that story is white. So they took some liberties, they gave some diversity. We'll talk about the other characters too, but yeah, all the characters in that book are white. This was a good idea, because I think a lot of times when they do this, we talked about this with Rogue One, we talked about it with a lot of films that we talk about in the last 5 years, boys. Diversity can be thrown in your face, and it can make you feel angry while you watch the film. I did not feel that here. I think all of these people deserve to be here, and I feel like this is a natural set of people, and I enjoyed all of them.
It doesn't feel like a stunt, and no. It does not feel like a mandate. It just feels like this is what the world would be of these kids going out to do this. So I thought it was just spot on.
Well, especially because they cut the participants down in half. They went from 100 to 50 in my research, which I also think was a wise choice because, you know, this movie's not even 2 hours. So you have to be efficient with your time, and I think you'd lose some characterization with a larger cast. But I've complained a lot about forced diversity, especially with a lot of what Disney has done. I didn't have that instance because I never felt like the movie was... It's got an undercurrent of messaging because everyone's doing this for different reasons. But I also feel like none of these characters are just token stereotypes. And they're not using their race as the character, the sole trait of character definition. So I think this is well done. And as far as this actor, he's having the career that I wish John Boyega had. Because I think Boyega's also tremendously talented, but just didn't get these type of roles. And this guy was the best part of Romulus, and I think he's probably the best part of this. Although I am a little annoyed, it's the thing of you got a 30-year-old guy playing it. What's supposed to be a teenager?
I was just about to say that. Yeah, he was 32 during this, and these are supposed to be late teens. I don't think about it. I had read that later, and yeah, it did kind of bug me too. But I think the way he's cast, I think it works. Adam, you and I mean, this is 90210 casting, right? When we grew up, that was our joke, is we would say, oh, look, they're playing a teenager. They're like 30 years old. It must be 90210.
It is, and I'm just glad that the age didn't even cross my mind. I figured they could be anywhere from 18 to mid-20s. 20s, or you know, maybe from 18 to 29 was my assumption. So if they said it was teenagers, I missed it, and I'm glad I did. I don't bump in on it, but that's a good point.
We're meeting Stebbins, who's a fitness nut, and we have Baker, played by a name, guys, I'm never going to pronounce. We then meet Curl.
Tut. Just call him Tut.
Okay.
I'm not even going to try that last name.
Yeah. We then meet Curly, who's 18, and then we are also meeting Olsen, played by Ben Wang, and Berkovich, played by Charlie Plummer. Not a weak one in this bunch, guys. I like all these characters. Not that I like them as people. I just like how diverse this cast is. You know, I like everybody that we've assembled here.
Mad props to the cast, the casting exec on this, because she did a great job.
We then meet the Major, played by a sunglasses-wearing Mark Hamill. Okay, am I going to have as good things to say about Mark Hamill in this? I had a different interpretation of this role as I was reading that book. I think Mark Hamill works for this movie. He's not like a tall, very imposing guy, but I think that's the point. I think the point of this is we have a guy who is small, but he thinks he's big. You know, he's like the small dogs who always think they're big, and he's trying to act tough on this, and he's not really as tough as he's making himself out to be. Matt, as the big Mark Hamill fan on this podcast, what do you think of Mark Hamill in this movie?
Well, Mark Hamill's vocal work. Last Jedi aside, I don't think he has a strong... For the longest time, I didn't think he was a good live-action actor, but I don't know what's happened to him in the last couple of years. Maybe it's because he's been able to put Luke Skywalker to bed, and he's taking roles that, like, character actors would take. Like, I thought he was really good in The Legend of Fall of the House of Usher. I thought he was really good in Life of Chuck earlier this year.
He was in a Stephen King movie earlier this year, Life of Chuck.
And I do think he works here. A lot of it, though, is because Mark Hamill's best work is vocal work, and there's a lot of stuff where you just hear his voice, which I think works, but also, look, him and Stephen King are also very similar politically, and I think this is very much a dig at Trump in a lot of ways. The bloviating guy who thinks he's the 500-pound gorilla in the room, but has kind of a almost Napoleonic complex. I think his casting works here more than I was expecting it to, because I I've seen Mark Hamill in person at Comic-Cons. He's not a physically imposing guy as far as height goes. And he's now in his 70s, which is also hard to believe. But, you know, it makes all the sense in the world. Ironically, I was thinking, like, I could see Harrison Ford in this role based on how it's written. Because I did some research. But Hamill works a lot more than I thought he would.
Yeah, I agree. I've never found him to be good live action until pretty recently, vocal work notwithstanding. I think he was tremendous in The House of Usher. And here, I think he does a good job. He doesn't detract. I don't get Mark Hamill. I think he does what he needs to do without taking apart, without taking away from some of the tremendous acting that we get from the, it's tough to say youths after we just talked about how old they are, but I don't think he distracts himself in this role while still complimenting what he needs to do.
Well, I'm also happy the movie's not relying on Mark Hamill as a get. He blends into the background pretty well. Like, and I feel like the movie never stops to say, hey, you're looking at Luke Skywalker this whole movie. And I also appreciate they didn't tell him, hey, just play the Joker, which you like, this could have been a very outlandish type of military villain, you know, and he also could have just been Arlie Ermey in Full Metal Jacket, which is just yelling and improvising for the whole movie. I get the sense he's actually sticking to the script.
I like that they keep him on that tank most of the time. I think he works when he's on that tank because he feels like he's hiding. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's in the background. And we're going to get some exposition later that explains where he came from, why he's here. But I like that decision to just kind of keep him on that tank. I think when he gets away from that truck, I think it kind of detracts from the character.
Adam, the sunglasses helped too.
Those giant aviators.
At the end of it, I thought he was going to be unable to walk. Like, I thought he was confined to that truck. And I thought that was, and I'm glad they don't go that way. They easily could have. And they could have made him be the big bad villain of this. And he is, but he's not. He's not your big bad. Just the world is.
Yeah. He's a product, but also someone who benefited from the state of the world and is an opportunist. You know, if things were pure and democratic, this is not someone who would have been able to rise to power. But I also appreciate, from an author who I commonly critique, explains too much, they give you just enough of him to explain why he is the way he is. And thankfully, he's not a demon. He's not a supernatural monster. You know, he's just a guy who was able to take advantage of the state of the world.
I think you hit it right on the head. I think he's an opportunist. That's a perfect way to describe him. So the Major is calling out names, and this is when we associate a number with all of them. The Major then says, it takes some heavy sack to sign up for this contest, and it integrates the value of work ethic. And
well, this is also very Vietnam-esque of, enlisting. You know, it's a show of not just masculinity, but patriotism. Like, you know, you're doing this for your country and rah-rah America. But it's also very, like, I got a lot of Hunger Games from this just because of Lawrence's direction. Like, he uses a lot of those group shots and a lot of close-ups like he does in the Hunger Games when they're actually fighting. So I see there was an actual reason to get this guy to direct, not just based on name value. I think a lot of his, what he did well in the Hunger Games, he's applying here. And thankfully, he's not having to rely on a shitty book and being told, hey, make something great out of this.
I agree. I think a lot of the directing choices in this are very good. I think some shots are beautiful. I think a lot of the way he shoots, like at one point, we're just seeing the feet go as they're talking and we're just hearing the footsteps. I think that's amazing. I think his instincts are very good here.
I like that this is the drama filled nature of how this is filmed is something I'm a big fan of.
And another thing I like about this is I'm liking how story beats are revealed. At this point, we have no idea what getting your ticket means. But the Major is saying, if you fall below 3 miles an hour, you get off track, you're going to get a warning and then you're going to get your ticket. We don't know that getting your ticket means that you're going to get shot. So I like the way that's integrated as well. So they're told to maintain a speed of 3 miles per hour, which, as I mentioned, was 4 in the book. And 3 warnings, you get your ticket, and if you step off, you will get your ticket without warning. And I also love about this is they sell that anyone can win, which, again, that's a really war mentality, right, Matt?
Well, it's also needed because it's part of why this movie works is, and this concept works, is it's not the Festivus feats of strength. Like, it's an endurance test. And unlike the Hunger Games, there's no, like, you can't win based on physical competition. I mean, you have a character who's, like, the equivalent of a scumbag, but it's not in the, like, I'm gonna, you know, stab someone while I'm walking, so I have the competition. I like how this is being depicted.
Here's a thing that I will mention, Matt, you mentioned that the marketing for this was pretty shitty. I think they were kind of driven into a corner because you guys mentioned the Hunger Games, and I get it. You know, Francis Lawrence is at the head of this, and they did advertise that. But in the Hunger Games, you had other things going on. You had relationships going on. You had love affairs going on. You had love triangles going on. You had the struggle of political power going on. Here, you're down to a walk. So I don't know how you market that. And I think they kind of ran to a corner with that.
It's a challenge. I think this is a difficult concept to market beyond it's an adaptation of Stephen King. But even then, they didn't. They also sold this on from the director of The Hunger Games.
Yes.
That was put in the advertising. Maybe if this was released towards like, because I think they could have backed into this. I mean, we'll talk about this movie justifies like award conversation. But this got very strong reviews. And I'm surprised it didn't play that more into its favor, especially in an Oscar, upcoming Oscar field that looks pretty weak, all things considered. And especially like none of the King movies, despite getting strong word of mouth, have gotten a lot of like financial revenue to show for it. So I think it's just a trait of his ilk at this point.
Although I would argue there is one love relationship in this movie, and we'll talk about it as we get into it. So the Major's looking at all the participants and saying that he sees hope. He asks, who's ready to win? And a shot is heard. And by the way, Jen thought this was all about a walk, so she had no idea what a ticket meant, which kind of goes into how things are revealed. And we'll talk about those tickets here in a bit.
I do think there is so much talk here at the very beginning about anybody can win, anybody can do it. I'm immediately thought with two things. Either it's all a setup and it's all fixed, or some of the people that we were just introduced are going to last about 10 minutes and we're going to completely be thrown on our heads.
They walk and see soldiers with guns mounted, and they walk by some dogs and desolate land, and we hear that the Major doesn't let spectators accept vocals until the final stretch. So he doesn't let spectators into this thing.
That confused me, because this beginning of it, where they say that it's this, they're doing it for the people. I thought I was going to see people much like the Hunger Games, and I'm glad they didn't. But what I think they're telling me is people are going to be huddled around a TV or a radio listening and watching these kids do the walk.
I was also wondering if we were going to get cuts to like a control room, like in the president's office,
mm-hmm.
sort of like, you know, Snow or the Game Maker in the Hunger Games movies. I'm kind of glad they didn't do that, because one of the things this movie really benefits from is setting and state of mind, where I feel like cutting away from this would have detracted from the tension that this movie creates pretty seamlessly throughout its runtime. That joke.
We're hearing warnings for 38, and we're going to be hearing this a lot. So much that we almost become numb to it, right? Warnings kind of come at us a lot throughout this movie, and I love the way that at some point as we're watching, we become numb to it.
Yes, but this movie does not take long before it is willing to do. And holy hell was my entire audience just aghast and had reaction to seeing this happen here, because we start on the walk and it's not far along and it doesn't cut away, it doesn't pull away, and for some of these up close kills that we get, it is unbelievable how realistic these look. It's horrifying.
The first one I think is a little too CGI. I was kind of worried when I saw the first one. I'm looking at it and I'm like, I don't know. But I think as we go on, I think the practicality comes in and you don't even think about it. And by the way, this first kill is the youngest. This is the youngest participant. He's 18. And so
it makes how is it that the Jojo Rabbit kid couldn't walk?
Yeah, right.
This kid, but I hope this kid has a good therapist, because between Jojo Rabbit and this... You know, because he made that movie when he was like 10.
I know. Ray warns Stebbins about stuffing himself with jelly sandwiches, and they're going to start making fun of Olsen for pulling gum out of his pocket. Barkovich isn't getting up after three warnings, but he does eventually get up. And what I love about this movie, and, you know, you can look at this and say, well, it's not a horror movie. It is. And you know what the horror of this movie is, guys? It's the anticipation. Because we're hearing warnings, but we don't know when the gun is going to go off. And I think that is the horror of this movie.
Well, yeah, this is the Jaws approach, where you get horror from the ever presence of suspense. Like, you know the shark is in the water, it can come out at any time. This, you know, with the warnings and the just the fact that there's literally no escape. Like, it's a straight, flat road. Because I'm thinking in my head, all right, have people tried to escape? Like, is this going to be fenced in? Do they have snipers surrounding the perimeter? No, they can do this just based on having a straight line and having them always be in their line of sight. And the horror also comes from the fact that this is not the first walk. They say this is like the 19th or something of that. So the fact that society fell so far that this is a yearly form of not just entertainment but patriotism, the horror comes from the fact that society fell to that extent.
Barkovitz says that he got a rest, and Olsen says, who needs a rest at this point? And we're at mile 7, and Baker asks about the wish, because at the end of this, you do get a wish, as well as an undisclosed sum of money.
All right, so this I did not like, specifically because my brain is thinking, oh God, is the winner's wish going to be that the walk never happens ever again, and it's going to be like this preachy, saccharine type of ending? I was dreading what this wish was going to turn out to be.
Pete asks Ray if he's religious, and Ray says no, but he's not a huge money freak either. Pete admits that he's here for the money. Ray says the prize doesn't really matter to him, and he says that they've been led to believe that's the way, and he says that the long walk is not chosen, and Pete says money isn't the most important thing they can do, but they can do a lot of good with a lot of money. They toss a ball back and forth as Pete offers him a smoke. Olsen warns Pete to save his wind, and Baker says that he does smoke. Then we have Hardiness making his way over here. I mean, this guy, you know this guy's not going to last. He's got glasses. He's got this notebook. He's taking notes. Adam, this guy's not long for this road, is he?
No, this Stephen King allegory is not. Of course he puts a writer in it. God damn, I'm surprised that he didn't find a way to put greasers in this thing. I kind of appreciated this, though, because I'm going to tell a story about this. I think this is idealistic young King here. I'm going to tell a story. I'm going to write about Vietnam. I'm going to make people care. And it is hard for me to say that I can't believe this, but like, there is none of this development, none of these people, I don't really think is done wrong. I'm kind of astonished and astounded. Even a few minutes in, I'm like, I can't believe they're going to do this so well. And I hope they can keep up the pace throughout the course of this film. But the way that it's explaining the rules, the walk, I mean, we don't get an explanation of any of everybody. We're going to do it as we walk. And fuck, that's just, it is so well done.
I agree. I think the way exposition is dispelled in this is tremendous.
Well, it's not all up front either. I like that the major doesn't talk for 5 minutes and outline every single rule. But I also think that's an intentional thing that he's doing to kind of, I don't know, keep certain things secret to their advantage. If you tell every single rule about how this goes, the walk would be over much quicker. And I think there is a certain amount of like sadism in prolonging this as long as they can by keeping information a secret, which is also kind of like the government trying to justify Vietnam and keeping certain things a secret. Like, that's very paramount in the undertones too.
For sure. Hardiness is told that if he wins, he won't need to write a book to be rich. And then we see that Curly gets a Charlie horse, and he ends up being the first one to die. Adam, you already outlined this earlier, but we're also seeing Ray help him. And as he's trying to help him, it doesn't really help because he's shot. And as I mentioned, this death concerned me. Too much CGI, though I will say it made Jen jump and put her hand to her mouth. This shocked the hell out of her. 20 minutes in, and we get the first title card. This is when the title card comes up, is after this death. And this was the footage they showed at Comic-Con, where for the first time ever, they had the lead kids out of Hall H because they realized, oh shit, we're gonna show this footage, we better not have kids in here. Just a great way to start this thing off. Great title card.
Between this and Thunderbolts, I've seen more child shootings in movies than in any like year I can recall. I appreciate that the movie doesn't hide from it. It's very upfront with the violence in a way that the Hunger Games could not be, because those were PG-13. And so I kind of like, within the context of the movie, I'm happy they're not pulling punches.
Yeah, because they so could have. You have the director of Hunger Games here. You're trying to advertise to people who...
it's very easy if you're a director and you're trying to play this, you know, to a more YA crowd. Uh-huh. You cut to like the front of the line and you just hear a gunshot. Or you cut to like the sun shape, a rooster or an animal or a squirrel, and the gun goes off.
And later on in this film, we do get the soft focus background killing, and you could have done that throughout the whole thing, but it makes it effective later by having it so in your face right up here.
The major says that the first and last deaths are the most powerful, and he calls for them to shout in Curly's name. Ray calls for another canteen as he knocks the compound. He tells Pete that he's doing it out of habit. Ray says that he's been tired for quite a while, and Pete brings up a good point. There's no such thing as a finish line in this race. That's the weird thing about this, boys. We're not going to a finish line. We're just going till everybody else dies.
Yeah, it's last man standing.
Yeah. Pete talks about living in the moments, and he says all he's trying to do is make it through this heat. Pete seems to be the positive one of this. For the most part, he's always smiling.
He is. Part of that, I'm wondering what his shtick is and what his game. I'm wondering if he's the plant in this, because sometimes he's just a little too, well, gee golly, Sarge, yeah. for me, you know? But then that does change later on, and I'm glad we get to see this side of him, because then we get to see the other stuff. And most of these characters we see go through not necessarily the entire changes you would get. Anybody who's done endurance races and stuff, it is amazing what your body goes through. We don't get all of that, but we get enough to really empathize as much as we can for being podcasting out of shape people here going to a movie. But yeah, I'm glad that we get changes of characters as we develop the film.
Ray mentions his dad, and Pete says that his dad is one smart motherfucker. And I'll say this, I like how Molnar has downtrodden the juvenile nature of the book. I've already mentioned some things about the book that it's just written by somebody who's just trying to find his voice. And Molnar has done a good job. At one point in the book, Ray is talking about his girlfriend. He has a girlfriend in this book. And all the other walkers kind of make fun of him because it's like, oh yeah, your girlfriend lives in Canada, right? He promises that she's going to be near the end of the race, which we'll get to that scene, which involves his mom and his mom only. But I'm glad that Molnar took that out. He doesn't have a girlfriend to walk to here. It's just all focused on these gentlemen and the way they go through this walk.
I think it would have been a little too much also of the military connection of, oh, you got to get a girlfriend before you go off to war. You got to get engaged before you go, you know, sign your enlistment papers, for example. Not saying that happened to anybody on this podcast, but I think it's done really well. And I think because of that, it is so effective when that moment comes later on.
Ray finds a fan in a spectator, no more than 14, and Pete tells him to let Pete have his fun. He also says that he likes Ray, but he won't hesitate to not pick him up when he falls. The relationship between these two is an interesting one. This is the thing that I characterize as a love relationship in this. In the book, it's weird. At one point, Ray asks him to jerk him off as they're walking, and they kind of make a joke out of it. And it's a very bizarre set of scenes. Again, a thing I'm really glad that Molnar cut out. But the illusions are still there. Matt, would you agree that the illusions of these two and the love they have is there?
Yeah, if you're looking for homosexual undertones in this, you can read them, but I'm glad they're not at the forefront, and they're also not played for. I mean, they swapped out the racism for some, you know, there's one character that is clearly homophobic. They joke about that, so King gets his bully mentality in there, but it's not laid on as thick as it could have been.
I didn't see it. I didn't feel that way. That's just me. I know that I've seen it alluded to in the articles and stuff since. It wasn't there for me, and I'm glad it wasn't. I was perfectly okay with it not being, but I can also see, I could see people seeing it there. I just didn't read it that way.
Pete calls them the Four Musketeers, as it's all for one and one for all. And we hear that number one, Ewing, he's getting warned as he gets a seizure, and they turn and they hear the shot. So Adam, this is exactly what you said. Whereas we had it up close and personal before, now we're hearing it and makes it more effective, right?
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to zoom into every kill to have it just as effective as that first one.
Pete says he keeps hoping that part of people dying gets easier, and Ray says that that's what he's afraid of. We see them continue to walk, and Pete says he can get horny for Ray if he needs to. Stebbins says that he's clear on warnings as they talk about food, and Olsen complains about pain in his leg. I love these watches that keep track of the speed. Adam, remember these black and gray watches? the black liquid in them? And Ray gets Olsen on the right track. This Olsen character, interesting character. We're going to find out later that he's married with a kid. It's actually a different character in the book. But Matt, this Asian character, he's a little weird, isn't he?
This is the one character that I think is overwritten with his backstory for the sake of added emotion, and I don't feel like it's needed. There's more than enough going on, and I think there's another reveal coming up that I rolled my eyes at. Sometimes I think less is more with giving motive for this, because some of them also feel very oversimplified, and this is one of them.
Pete hesitates to show his scar, and this is a big part of the book. In the book, it's pretty much a domestic violence situation where his girlfriend scratched him. And of course, they're not going to show that here because they want to keep Pete as, I don't want to say wholesome, but as likable as they can. And he just kind of diverges that as the race goes on. I'm glad that's out of here as well. Molnar just made some great choices here. Olsen drops his ration, and he says that he's fucking hungry, and Pete offers his. Barkovich makes fun of Rank's name, which causes Rank to take a few swings. Barkovich taunts him some more, and this causes Rank to get shot. And this death is going to eat at and haunt Barkovich the entire rest of the walk.
I felt that it's not as explained as it thinks it is, because there's times where it feels like fighting is against the rules, but I don't think that's clearly laid out. I do love that it eats at him, but at the same time, I don't feel like he's ever a good character that's kind of going down a path of like The Shining, like he's just starting to just go mad because this is eating at him. I think we're supposed to feel that way. I like the development, but I don't think it's as good as the movie thinks it is.
Interesting, because it is laid out that you can't actually swing at anybody, but you can taunt them. And that's exactly what he does here, and he just feels bad about it the rest of the race.
Yeah, it's almost like you can manipulate people through their emotions, but you can't get into like physical altercations. But I also wonder if that's a hard written rule, or if that's just something that it's like the NFL commissioner, where they change it when they feel like it.
They call him a murderer, and this bugs Barkovich. Barkovich then calls out Pete's gayness, and we stay on the shot of Rank's dead body as they walk by. Pete points out a crow, and they see a service station right off the road. Harkness starts blabbing a bit, and they see and smell that 45 has the shits. And Adam, as somebody who has been in marathons, this happens in races, doesn't it?
Oh my goodness, that it literalized this so much is absolutely crazy. I expected to see some like dehydration cramps. I expected to see some of the other stuff. I didn't think we'd get full-blown just shizen essence fucking in this thing like this. Oh my god, this is gross and as accurate as you could probably be.
He sits down to finish his shit and gets shot for it. Deben says that the last 20 always have to shit, and Major once again compliments them on their sack to last this long.
You never think of it until this point that are these guys shitting and eating and taking, I mean, shoot, I've taken a piss on my bike many times, but how are you doing these just normal bodily functions?
Mm-hmm. The Major says that their first night is almost done, and with enough determination, they will see the dawn. Pete and Ray, they're pretty much tied at the hip here, aren't they, Matt?
Yeah, which made me fully realize, I mean, it doesn't take Stevie Wonder to see that these are going to be the last two.
We get a mini flash of, we've been on this race this entire time, but now we're getting a mini flashback to Judy Greer preparing a cake as Pete wakes Ray out of his doze. Pete knows that he was dozing and dreaming about his mom and the lullaby she used to sing him. He says that her name is Mom and then changes it to Jenny. So he's kind of hesitant to reveal his mom here. Matt, is this what you were saying as overwritten?
No, it's another one involving the Major.
Okay.
That I was annoyed by.
They compliment her perceived looks, and warnings are going on in the background. He says that he didn't realize how much he would miss her, and he says that she'll be waiting for him at Freeport. Pete says that he doesn't have a lady, and Ray says that he hates the guy shouting warnings, and Ray starts yelling at Pete that he wants Ray to have a bullet in his head, and this whole sequence is just gripping as alliances are broken and people are taken out left and right. This whole scene at night is pretty hallucinogenic. Like, it's really weird. I didn't know if this was actually real or not until we cut to the next morning.
I didn't even know if we were going to be doing this at night. You know, I was wondering, was it going to be nonstop? Is it going to be you get 4 hours sleep and then you get to go the next day, kind of military? And when they did this, I wasn't expecting that they are going to use this to cull the field and whittle down so much of, you know, what we have. But this is brutal. And I like that it's dark, but you can still see enough. You know, we've complained about that in God knows enough movies, but this is a great scene.
But I think it's also important to perpetuate the idea of hallucinations and delusion based on the ending. Mm-hmm. And how you can read that. The ending would not be as open-ended as it tries to be if you weren't teasing delusions at this point.
Ray is hearing taunts that Barkovich is shouting at him, and Pete stops him from falling. He gets a canteen and pours it on his head, and Pete tells him to put one foot in front of the other. He's trying to get him back in rhythm. Ray says he didn't mean what he said, and they end up being isolated in the dark. And then we cut to dawn as we enter mile 59. How do you like these subtitles that announce what mile we're on?
It works for the story. I like it until I'm sitting in a movie theater doing math in my head. Because I am literally sitting here going, okay, wait a minute. If they're going a minimum of 3 miles an hour, this is how many. Holy shit, they've been walking this long. And then I'm just trying to think about it and just imagine going through this. Because imagine if you trip, what it's like just rolling an ankle and just something as simple as that, and you're going to get killed for it. But I am feeling it when they start to put these numbers up.
Yeah, I'm thinking of those title cards from SpongeBob.
Oh, jeez.
3 hours later.
Ray asks Pete to talk to him, and Ray tells Pete that he needs to win for other reasons. He says he doesn't think he'll win, and Pete says the same exact thing. Pete He says that he thought the guns were going to have signs in them that say bang, but to his surprise, they didn't. A line straight from the book.
I did too.
A line. No, Mark Hamill did that in Batman for 20 years when the Joker had prop guns.
This was a line straight from the book. He says that there's something in the brain that he doesn't have, which is he doesn't want to hear people that badly. And when the time comes, he just sees himself sitting down. He says he thinks there's 18 left and the herd is thinning out. And then we cut to mile 67 as Olsen just doesn't look good. This guy, how he lasts as long as he does, I have no idea, because he's on rubber legs for like 100 miles.
Mm-hmm. I guess, well, the rules, it's like as long as you keep moving.
Yeah.
Doesn't say that you have to have artificial legs. My question is like, okay, so could a kid in a wheelchair do this as long as they kept the pace?
Dude, I don't.
Like, did they explain that in the book?
No, that never comes up. Parker finally pipes up, which almost causes a fight, and Ray just calls him a bumpkin. Pete tries waking up Olsen, and Pete says that he slept just great. We then cut to Harkness, number 49, who's been walking on his hurt ankle for the last set of miles. God, Adam, I'm so glad you mentioned this. This happens in the whole chaos of the night before. We do see Harkness twist his ankle at that time. We mm-hmm. don't think about it, but now when we cut to him, we're on mile 67, his ankle is about coming off, and he's still walking, and my God, was this painful to look at.
This is... It's so painful to see. And the thing is, you still don't have a choice. I mean, it's walk or die, you know? So I expected to see a bone sticking out. I thought I might see somebody walking on a stump at some point. This is, oh, man.
So subtle.
Yeah, I was half expecting to see, like, George Romero-esque zombie effects where his leg, like, falls off and dissolves.
Pete tells people to stop looking, and they're going to tell Ray that he's too soft and that I'll get him killed. Pete calls Barkovich a killer, which, again, trips him off, and he tells Pete that he has big plans for him. This is something that isn't paid off, is Barkovich is barking at Pete that he has big plans for him. You know, you're going to go down. It doesn't really happen, and that was one payoff I was hoping for that we didn't get.
You're waiting for it, and then they kind of double down and triple down on it later, and it still doesn't deliver. So I don't know what's cut out, but it doesn't do what they say it's going to do.
I was wondering if this was one of those things directly from the book that just got lost in translation.
Pete apologizes to Hank for busting his balls, and the Major compliments them for making it 100 miles. Stebbins says that the Major is fresh because he sleeps at night and showers. So this is when we get a little bit of exposition on the Major. Stebbins then sneezes, and Ray asks if he's getting sick. Stebbins says it was...
Oh, no, this is how the stand starts.
Yeah, right. We're going into that.
This right here, though, this is the equivalent of somebody hiding a zombie bite.
Yeah. Stebbins says it was allergies, as one of them runs for the nearby shop and gets killed. And what I like about this, I don't know if I like it, but all of these deaths are affecting me. Like, there's not one of these that doesn't get to me. I never become desensitized to it. And I think that was the danger of doing this story, is you have 50 people, you're going to have 49 deaths. I am affected by each and every one.
Yeah, even the ones that I don't like, quote unquote, the ones I don't know. Something about it gets to me. And that's different than the Hunger Games, where you had clear antagonists, protagonists, quote unquote villains, you know, because we knew who our heroes were. Even with Pete and Ray, like, it's not quite that clear. So I care about these people, and some of them, it doesn't feel dirty. It just feels so gritty and real that it's, man, you can't help but hurt a little bit.
Yeah. And it's also like not just them getting pulled off to the side on their knees and shot. It's done without a thought. Like, they don't even make a big scene out of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like the Hunger Games where part of it is we have to broadcast it for dramatic effect, like it's shot out of a movie.
Yeah, like at one point, Olsen's looking and he says, hey, look, we're on candid camera. But are they on camera? I don't see any
camera. This bugged me. This bugged me because that is a camera that's at the end of that, uh-huh. But we never see them on TV. I think something got lost there.
Well, they're like, oh shit, the Running Man comes out in a month. We can't do that.
We're now on mile 103, and Baker says that if he wins, he might wish for a foot massage. And he then says that he actually wants a space rocket for the moon. Ray mentions one kid who wished for a pet elephant and got one. Olsen says that he would have wished for 10 naked ladies, which is funny when we learn that Olsen is actually married with a kid. In the book, it's a different character. In the book, it's not Olsen, it's somebody else.
That's why you wish for 10 naked ladies.
What a debate this 10 lady debate is. But what I like about it, it keeps things light.
It is. And I could say that if we were doing this fucking disasterly thing, this is the type of ball busting that you would absolutely hear.
Definitely. Pete says he would wish that The Long Walk has two winners, which would allow for hope. Ray calls it goddamn beautiful, and Ray says that he's not saying his wish. He's going to keep it to himself, at least for a little while. He counts 15 that are left, and Olsen says his piece of gum has no flavor, and when the gum goes, he'll go.
Ray, boy, let's guess what happens here.
Ray says he wants his wish to change things, and Pete once again calls Barkovich a killer. Ray says that he'll be dead or winning in the next few days, and Pete says, fuck the long walk and fuck the major, and we get a nice set of chance here. We're keeping people together, even though only one of them's going to survive. Matt, was this the stuff you were worried about, all this stuff about wishing for two winners, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I was thinking, like, are they going to find some way to cheat the system? I really didn't want that.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at
the end of it. They can't have a movie this downtrodden and oppressive and then do a complete 180 with an uplifting ending. Like, it just, it would have felt like a cheat.
That was the end of the Hunger Games. You know, it was, yeah, oh, we're going to sit down together. You can kill us both, or we can both be winners. So I did worry it was going to be the exact same ending.
We cut to night again, and man, is it pouring rain. Pete and Ray are once again holding each other up, and Ray asks Pete if he'd like some sleep. We cut to daytime, and mile 144, as Ray throws the ball to Pete again, Baker has to take a shit, and Ray yells that he needs a gun to his head to get up from taking a shit. Talk about how much they crap a day and their uses of laxatives. And Olsen says that they need a good meal, a good screw, and a good crap, as he says. Boy, if that doesn't sum up a perfect day, I don't know what does. Pete asks Baker to break off, as he doesn't smell very good. And then Pete asks Ray to say what his wish is now that they're alone. And this is when Ray says that his dad was his hero, and he wanted to show Ray things that could get him jailed, which included uninhabited music and books. And this is when he was taken from him. So we get the flashback to Jenny and his dad and how the major comes in and takes him outside to kill him. All right, a few things about this before you guys chime in. Yes, this was in the book. The reason why they came to get his dad was because he talked bad about the long walk. The major got wind of it and took him away. Now, he did not take him outside and kill him and execute him in front of his family. That is here strictly for the movie. But Matt, how'd you feel about getting this backstory with his dad?
I didn't like this. I mean, I would have liked it better if the major was not involved. But I think because this movie is thinking, oh, we need a clear, like, antagonist to hate, you know, it's putting a further pin on it and just bludgeoning a point. I complained a lot about conveniences in movies, and this is one that really irked me.
Yeah, I'm reading 1984 right now, so think, speak, and being dragged out of a home. I mean, it is so literal translation of that book that all you did was literally exactly that. For talking about your government, you're going to get dragged. So I get it for the story. It almost would have been more effective just to have him disappear and not be resolved by the end of it.
Pete says that he's sorry, and that's not all right. Ray says that if he wins, he's going to ask for the carbine and kill the major for revenge. So he finally gets his wish out there. Ray says that no one wants this more than him because his dad was the last decent person on the planet, and this is his chance to cut the head of the dragon. Pete asks if he knows how hard it is to kill a man, and it'd be sad if he became that kind of man. He also says that what matters is us and this moment. So, some more bonding between these two. Adam, how'd you feel about the wish?
My issue is thinking that it all begins and ends with the major. To me, that's telling us that there's nobody beyond him that would keep it going. So I got an issue with it there. And I think this is just setting me up that Ray is actually going to be a villain by the end of this. And I think that's what's happening. I'm glad it doesn't. But this movie says carbine as many times as it says steps in this film. I get it. It's just a little too, I don't know. It's fine. It's so much of this is great that when something is fine, it just kind of sits there.
Yeah, I have a huge problem with this because you're taking something that is an institutional flaw with society and pinning it on one person. It's the definition of you're killing the man, not the idea. And I think that's very simplistic in a movie that is trying to commentate on something, you know, much larger than that. And I think it's probably the laziest bit of writing in the movie. And it kind of, I think it's a hindrance collectively on my thoughts.
Well, to be fair, in the confines of this movie, the major did kill his dad in front of him. So I can see why these feelings would come out.
No, I get that. But I feel like it just deviates into a revenge story, which I don't feel like we're building to for the first two thirds.
And also, that is not in the book at all. This wish is not in the book.
Oh, so my problem then, I can blame the writer for this.
Yeah, this is Molnar's edition. It all cultivates in the end, which...
You know, because this is literally the same problem. I came up with the perfect analogy. This is the exact same problem I have with Sam Raimi's movie, The Quick and the Dead. where it's a horrible like institution that's put on by this town with the dueling competition. And then you find out, oh, Sharon Stone's just doing this because she wants revenge for Gene Hackman killing her father. So it's you're going after the person, not the institution. It's the same problem I have with that.
Why not just watch everybody else doing the long walk, especially since it's in your home state anyway, and just shoot the major as they walk by?
Ray also says that his mom doesn't know because this is bigger than his mom could imagine. He also points out people watching this walk from the side of the road because they are the same. He says that vengeance is not enough. It doesn't help if you walk ahead of the pack. Here's one thing. Okay, so I like that you do not benefit from walking faster than everybody else. In the book, Stebbins is the last one at all times. He's keeping the exact minimum. So it doesn't help if you walk ahead. It helps if you keep the perfect pace, which is the speed limit. And I feel like this movie doesn't really delve on that a lot. It does in the book, but not this.
Yeah, there's other stuff you could have done. I could see somebody going like, oh, I'm going to speed up and then try to slow down and then maybe get his warnings and freak out. You know, they do a brilliant job of explaining the rules as we go. And even that first one at the beginning where somebody takes a break until he gets his third warning, jumps up and is like, ha, I can walk for 3 hours and I'm going to be fresh when you're going to need that break. So it's done well elsewhere. I don't need it, but they could have done it and it would have made sense.
Pete asks Ray if he wants to walk with him for a while, and Ray says yes. And then we cut to mile 170, and Olsen just does not look good. We see someone get bopped down and have his legs run over by a tank and shot.
What? Okay, this, that they still count him down before they shoot him. Oh, fuck. Yeah.
That feels like a bit of dark humor. I don't know, man. The guy has no legs. He's been run over. He's not going to be able to walk.
No, that is a, I'm laughing because that is a Joker gag.
You ain't got no legs, Lieutenant Dan.
We see another one. He sees this. He rips off his clothes and goes off the side of the road where he shot. And I like this because they're not shooting him in the head. They shoot him in the gut because it prolongs the death and it makes people say, no, you can't do that. You cannot run off the side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
This does happen in the book pretty much word for word.
It's this level where you're 4 days in, 5 days into walking. Like, I need to see some hallucinations and people just losing their mind at this point.
And if you ask Cooper Hoffman, he did say they walked 15 miles a day. They didn't just sit in front of a green screen on a treadmill. They were out walking, and they shot it in scene order, too, which hardly ever happens. And I think you see the effects. I think everybody is showing the effects as we get deeper into the film.
I'm going to give this a compliment that if it gets around to award season, I think it deserves. The cinematography and the way that this is blocked and staged, because it's outdoors and the continuity is there. The sun, the way that they look, that I never feel like they've missed an edit or had to jerry-rig it around. Or it feels so natural that it's unnerving.
Great point.
Yeah, this doesn't feel like a movie that had to be saved in the editing room, which I thought it would have to be just given how most movies are shot non-chronologically. You know, you shoot based on schedules and all that. So maybe that was also intentional because they wanted to make this feel as much of an endurance test in the production as it is in the script.
We then cut to night and mile 201. Stebbins asks Garrity if he's tired and exhausted, and Stebbins doesn't believe that he's exhausted. Ray says that he doesn't know why he talks to Stebbins. It's like talking to smoke. That was a funny line. Olsen is exhausted as he's lost his appetite. Ray tries talking to Olsen, who is just going on instinct at this point. Olsen turns around and goes to the blockade and gets shot in the gut, which again is done to cause an example. So Olsen is finally shot. We then see number 46 get shot, and Ray turns around and pulls Baker up as they leave Olsen. Olsen is screaming in pain, and Baker is distraught. He wasn't able to save him. Ray says that he did a good thing, and Ray and Pete walk together. So another crazy set of scenes. Ray's trying to be the good guy here. Olsen's being taken out. I think all of this stuff is pretty powerful.
It is, and we did a mass culling at the beginning of this. We lost a few people in the middle. You kind of feel like you're gearing up for a finale because you're suddenly whittling down some of the characters we spent the most time with, that we saw some development, and that we got to like and dislike. And even the ones that I dislike, as they get offed, it's still effective in how I'm affected by it.
We cut to the morning and mile 209. Parker's pissed that Olsen was married and went out like that. He said that Olsen told him at the drop-off and that his wife's name was Clementine, like the song. Pete suggests that they do something for his widow when they win, and Parker says that sounds like some bleeding heart bullshit. But this is from the book. They all do make a pact to do something for his wife when one of them wins. Even Stebbins, who says, go team. I like Stebbins a lot in this. He's kind of underplaying things. You know, we have so many people here going pretty big, right? But Stebbins is kind of underplaying this.
He is, and you're waiting for him kind of from the very beginning when he's introduced. You know, he's obviously the tribute from District 1, you know, that's put up here. So I'm waiting for the big reveal. I don't like the big reveal that we do get, but when he's just starting to lose it, where he's just like, he's sick and he is so pissed that he's trained for this, and he's just like, I can't believe I'm getting fucking sick. You wait 2 years for a vacation that you've saved up and planned for, and a few days before you get sick, or you get sick on vacation. It's just the irony of, I'm better than all of you, and it's going to be hay fever or these fucking, there's something great and natural there.
Yeah. So go to your point, Adam. Stebbins says that he hasn't been sick in 10 years, yet this irony isn't stopping him from winning. Barkovich asks why they didn't ask him to help, as he just got off on the wrong foot with them. Barkovich asks to be his buddy, as he didn't want to see that rank kid go. He apologizes and says that it's not his fault, and Ray says that he's a part of it now. Barkovich gets twitches and says that he doesn't want to die. They all have to go, just not like this. Pete asks if he's okay, and Barkovich yells at him. Ray calms him down and says that he's going to tell Pete that Barkovich wants to be a part of the plan. Barkovich says that he's got to go, as Barkovich walks ahead and stabs his own throat with a spoon.
With a spoon, you twit, it'll hurt more.
I was just going to say that, God damn it.
This is another example of the juvenile nature of the book. In the book, you know what he does? He rips his throat out with his hands. He just rips it apart, which you can't do, obviously.
Here, no, unless you play Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, exactly. Here, they give him a spoon to do it with, which I don't even know if that would work either. But, man, it's a powerful scene, though.
Yeah, this gets me, and it's some of these, I mean, once you know, some of the, just the accepting of your fate, there is something horrible about this and powerful. And this is when I start looking at this film as something different than what it is and what I thought it was. And to me, this film is just life. Mm-hmm. And that's all we're watching here is people living their life and marching to the end. And this is when it fucking hits me and I get a different view.
What I like about this is, yeah, he stabbed his own throat with a spoon, but they shoot him anyway. This scatters
after
the
counting him down.
Yeah, right?
After counting him down. Like, they never deviate from that.
Nope. And this, of course, scatters the horses. We cut to mile 260. As Ray has a cough now and Parker sings some Clementine, getting everyone else involved. Yes, this is from the book. And by the way, these cars burning up. Matt, could you guess what one of these cars is?
Was it a Plymouth Fury?
It was a 1958 Plymouth Fury. Yes, sir. It's
yes,
burning
it
on the
is.
Road.
I pointed at that screen like Leonardo DiCaprio.
And I'm sure the people right next to you were pretty responsive to that. Ray talks to Parker about how close he is to his mom, and this makes Parker jealous. All he'll see is the pigs, and he's scared and homesick. Ray says that they all are homesick. Parker calls them both crazy, and Pete tells Ray that all he wants for him is to keep walking. Ray's shoe gets tangled and falls off, so he has to kick it off. And now they're in Freeport, so this is when Ray sees his mom. And in the book, guys, this is his girlfriend, not his mom. Pete warns Ray not to stop, and he goes right to her. He's walking away and screaming that he's sorry, and Pete says not to do this in front of her. This is pretty powerful stuff.
This is hard not to shed a tear during, for anybody who's been with a parent, who's lost a parent, who's lost a child, who's had a parent or had a child. So everybody, there is something raw in the way that this is done. This is written well. It's shot better and acted even better than that. This is superb, just this scene alone. And God damn, this just makes you want to curl up in a ball.
Yeah, I was worried how this was going to be handled once we got to the end, because I was dreading this getting overly schmaltzy, but I think they know just enough when to pull back and keep it on just the two of them. They show the mom enough.
Ray says that he should have stayed in the car. Pete says that Ray's been walking for 5 days, but Pete has been walking his entire life. He says that his parents died when he was little, and that he bounced from couches and basements and fields, but nothing was worse than picking fights and stealing shit. He says he tried robbing someone, and he was cut and left for dead. So this explains his scar in this movie, but again, as I mentioned in the book, it was domestic violence.
Yeah, I don't know if I would have liked that. This has got so much dark in it. I mean, that's kind of like throwing in, you know, like some sexual abuse or something like that, where you're like, just pull back a little bit. So yeah, I'm glad they moved some of that. There's enough horror in this that just feels right, as bad as fucked up as that sounds, that I don't want or need that. I think they handled it well. The changes, and I've looked into it to see, the changes that they've made, I can't think of one that I've been against so far.
Yeah, the key word is so far. But I'm also annoyed that, oh, don't worry, they still find a way to put bastard children in this.
Oh, yeah. Pete says that he wasn't upset because it wasn't the guy's fault that he got the scar. It was his. Pete says that it was fucking hard and he's here because he has nothing to lose. Again, this is setting him up to be a martyr. He tells Ray that he could have used a brother. He also suggests if Ray wins, he needs to choose love. Take the prize and go because he deserves it. We cut to mile 306. Esteban says that they need to make an agreement on giving no help to anyone and they all have to do it alone. So it's down to Stebbins, Baker, Parker, Pete, and Ray. Parker makes himself scarce right away as he grabs a gun and gets shot right in the gut for his troubles. And him kneeling and screaming, this is just powerful stuff to me.
Mm-hmm. He's one of the ones I thought had the possibility of doing a swerve to win at the end of it, because he's very background for about two-thirds of this.
He grabs the gun and shoots his leg with it. And then we cut to mile 324 as they're carrying Baker, who's now not in real good shape, as he feels like he's got an internal hemorrhage. He's held up from both sides, as Ray says, to keep walking a little longer. Baker says he's going home, and Pete tells him that he gave it his all, as well as made some friends. Ray says that he's been a hell of a friend. He thanks them both and asks if he can give this to his grandma. He makes them promise that they won't watch him as he breaks free and says he's going home. He walks backwards, and he's shot in the distance. This was the most powerful death for me. This fucking got me, man. I gotta say, I've said that I haven't become desensitized to these deaths. This one was the worst. I almost shed a tear at this.
Well, I think this works so well is Baker, you almost expect him to go earlier. I mean, even a movie trope, and I'm going to, and don't attack me here, but that you're going to have two black men towards the end of this. You just don't see that in most modern movies, shamefully. But the way that he does it, that everybody is trying until they know they can't. Everybody accepts it. Everybody knows that he has to go at that moment. And the way that it's done is heart-wrenching. And the way that you choose to go to your own death is not something that all of us can choose. And I think that's what the moral of this story is. And God damn, this is powerful.
Yeah, I was thinking of Terminator. There is no fate, but what we make.
Yep. We then cut. We're in the home stretch, boys. We cut to mile 326, as the major says. Guess what? They're in the home stretch. I don't even mean for that to happen. Stebbins tells the major to shut the fuck up, and my audience clapped at that moment. That's pretty great. The question is,
there's a lot of Republicans on Twitter who say that to Mark Hamill all the time.
And Stephen King.
Yeah. The question is asked, what would happen if they all knelt at the same time? And Stebbins says the reason he knows so much about the long walk, here we go, Matt, is because he's the rabbit. Which he describes. He says, maybe they should stop being rabbits and animals and start being people. And this is when he also mentions that he's the major's bastard son, and the major has dozens of them. He says the major's rabbit is his flesh and blood, and he'd like it to end with his head held high. Matt, I'm assuming you hate this.
Yeah, because now we have two simplified revenge motives. And this is just, okay, you've already done a really good job at keeping your antagonist in the background while still making him a presence. Again, I don't like this notion of just making him now the archetypical villain in absence of the concept itself. This movie seems to be all about, you know, rebellion against the institution, but it's also frustrating that they're targeting it towards one specific person who took advantage of the situation, not necessarily is the archetype of why we're at where we're at. I hate this so much. And is this in the book?
Yes.
Okay, so this I can blame King for.
Yeah, you can blame King for this.
This feels like a twist for the sake of a twist.
I'm okay with there being a rabbit. When the words come out of his mouth, I'm the rabbit. I was like, oh, like, I know exactly what that means. And I'm like, that's great. He was chosen to set the pace. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's, you know, you see it, and then it's not going to work out how you thought. I was waiting for that. Like I said, he's District 1, District 2. He was favored. The bastard child of the major. Don't need it, don't like it, don't want it. And I don't even know if it's true at the end of the day. I mean, you look at this guy, you look at them. Believe me, Mark Hamill did not father this kid.
I mean, yeah, this kid looks like a model.
Julie Greer has a better chance of being that kid's father than Mark Hamill does. So this is just a step that I don't need and a step too far. Him being chosen to be a rabbit and it not going the way that they need, I am all for that. But the father, the son, especially because we already did that exact point, is just no thanks.
Well, I don't know if it's just because of my association with this book and how much it spoke to me, but I didn't have too big a problem with this. Again, maybe it's just because I was expecting it. Stebbins says that he always loved the rain. He says that there's going to be crowds, ones who want to see the major do the final kill, and Ray says it's been nice walking with you. Stebbins stops and is shot as he begs them to shoot him. Now they're Down to two, boys. Ray says that there's a 50% chance now as it starts raining. Ray tells Pete that when he was a kid, he never thought about death until he was confronted by it. He says there's something about being with these boys, which is the only guarantee is that you're going to die. And if you're lucky, you can choose those moments. Every moment matters, and he's not afraid of those moments anymore. We're at mile 366. As they walk into crowds of people with umbrellas, Pete looks at Ray and then stops. Ray says that he's stopped, and Pete says that he's going to do this for your mom. There's a struggle. As Ray goes behind Pete, he pushes him ahead and kneels down unexpectedly. Ray gets shot, and Pete asks, what did he do? He says he loves him as he dies at the hands of the Major. Ray apologizes to his mama as the Major shoots him, and it's at this point that Pete... Okay, so before I get to the whole ending here, this is changed from the book. In the book, Ray is the one who wins. I like this change a lot because we have built Pete, and Matt, you've mentioned this, as being the martyr, as being the one who's going to make the decision to sacrifice himself for Ray to win. He does try that, but they pull a fast one and make Pete the winner. A
couple things that happen here. I got a problem with a crowd showing up out of nowhere because these guys could have suddenly tripped 2 miles ago and nobody would have seen this. I don't know why this crowd being here at the end bugs me, but it really does. It just, for them to know where the ending is going to be, I thought that it was going to be the other way. Clearly, can I think it's set up that way? But my entire time, I thought Ray was going to win, but he was going to pick Pete's wish. And I think that's what we're meant to believe. I love the way this is done. I like that he picks up Pete and they start walking just for him to suddenly stop. There's something powerful about that. I like the change from, especially in some other King's books, just the magical black man that's going to save the day by sacrificing himself. It didn't go that way. And it usually goes that way. So I'm glad it didn't. It's a powerful moment. It works for me. I think some of the acting we get from Hamill and some of the other stuff right here at the end gets hokey, and that's a shame. But I am a big fan of the change because I heard how it was before. And yeah, I'm all in for this.
This was a completely justified change because I did not want this to be literally another Green Mile.
Yeah.
Not just because there's walking, but with the, you know, I didn't want him to be, you know, Michael Clark Duncan 2.0. Thankfully, he's not. I thought this was went against my expectations in a good way.
Okay, so let's get to the wish and the big change that is made. It's at this point that Pete makes the decision to do Ray's final wish. As America the Beautiful is being sang, Pete gets up and asks for the carbine. He gets it, says this is for Ray, and then finishes Ray's wish after an extended aim. All right, so before I get to your guys' thoughts, let me just talk about the background here. Like I said, in the book, Ray wins, but there's no supernatural stuff here. But in the book, Ray is walking to a dark figure that he cannot reach. Is this a character that King's been working on in The Gunslinger at this point? He's been writing him in high school, Mr. Randall Flagg? That's never really said. So when Molnar and Lawrence decided to change this ending, of course, King has final say. So they changed the ending and they had to give it to King to give his blessing. Molnar's whole rationale is he saw King bless the ending of The Mist, which I'm not going to give away here because of someone on this podcast, but is way darker than the actual book itself. And to his surprise, King did give his blessing. And I think this is so much better than the book as Ray's turning towards his fate. And also, is this really happening? Is the fact that he got the gun and killed the Major happening? Or is he dead? Is this the afterlife? This is so up in the air, and that can be very, very frustrating. But in this instance, I find it to be very fulfilling.
So I think the ambiguity is intentional. And I think that's why I am fine with it on that level. If this is literal, him shooting the Major, then either his soldiers would have just opened fire blown Pete to smithereens like Peter Weller and RoboCop, or B, the crowd would have gone just deathly silent and would have rioted and killed him. Like, if we became that bloodthirsty and were denied on that front, even though he won fair and square, I would have cried foul. So I read this as the long walk is literally him, you know, walking into the rain, as in the afterlife. I think that's bringing the title full circle. That's how I'm reading it. So I appreciate that it's open to interpretation. That's preceded by including like delusions and hallucinations by some of the characters early on. I'm okay with this. I'm bothered more by the inclusion of just making the Major like the villain for the last third of this movie more than I would have liked. That's my biggest issue.
I almost wish that we didn't see the Major get out of the tank here at the end, you know, that he could shoot Pete and be okay with it, or Ray. I just don't like that it takes so long after he gets the carbine. I mean, this, Hamill's been good through this, except at the very end where he's like, don't worry, boys, he's not gonna shoot me. It's not done well, and I don't believe it. You know, if he got the carbine, shot him, dropped it, walked away, I'm okay with it. I don't think the troops would shoot him. I think that he got his victory fair and square, and everybody was willing to give it. I like the end. I like the way it goes. Like I said, other than it just taking so long with him and Major facing off, you know, looking at each other. Other than that, I'm down for the change. I'm down for what it means. I'm down for people that give it an ambiguous ending. This is one of King's better adaptations that I've seen. Well, I'm going to get into thoughts. I'm not going to do that, but I'm glad they made the change. I'm glad King either signed off on or helped make these changes because I think it helps.
Yeah, and there's very few King adaptations where I can say I prefer the movie ending versus the book ending.
I can definitely say I prefer this ending to the book as well. All right, scale of 1 to 10. What do we give The Long Walk? Adam, go ahead, sir.
Not a film I knew what I was going to get going into it. Those that have listened to this know that I couldn't be a little hard on King's works at times, possibly. But what I saw in this was kind of a masterful work of writing. This film is people walking on a road and delivering dialogue. That's what this movie is. And that movie is hard to sell, clearly. It's hard to do right. And if I would have learned early that Lawrence was doing this, I would have, as I said, just I would have been so far against it even more so. This movie doesn't just deliver on the source material, from what I understand. It kind of elevates this type of film. This is the type of movie that justifies, fuck, God damn it, Scorsese, cinema. I mean, this is something that is powerful. It works. The medium just delivers here. The acting is top notch from Cooper Hoffman, who, kid, your dad was astounding, and I'm glad you're here to be a part of it. But David Johnson, again, is so fucking good in a role. Like, he steals it so much that I'm waiting for a swerve, and when it doesn't happen, I'm okay with it. But a bunch of unknowns carrying a King work for 326 miles at 3 miles an hour, and I'm engaged from the second I get in the seat, credits start rolling, and we all sit there for a minute because the heft of this film and the thoughts and power behind it just resonate. This is looking at life and the letter of acceptance you get when you're born and deciding how you're going to go out. You don't know how long your walk is going to be. And that's what I got out of this. I think this thing is pretty damn amazing. I don't see this as a film I can watch repeatedly, you know, or annually, because it just hits. But I do think it's a great film, and I think people who love drama should really see this film, because I think it would resonate with a lot of people. This is a very strong 8 on 10. I wish it was doing even better at the box office. I can understand why it's not, but if you haven't seen The Long Walk, watch it. Just be in the mood, but watch it.
Wow, Adam just gave a Stephen King adaptation an 8 out of 10. Didn't think I'd ever see the day. Matt, what do you say, sir?
I think this is a testament to why movies are still as permanent as they are as far as entertainment, because this is a challenging premise on a script level to make cinematic and to make it compelling. This is the kind of thing that you could argue works better on a page than it would on the screen for the sake of pacing and narrative, all the things that you can exercise better in a book than you can in a movie. But I think this goes to show that challenge accepted. And for the most part, I was thoroughly impressed. This exceeded my expectations in a lot of ways. A very simplistic premise. Pardon the pun, they got a lot more mileage out of this than I ever thought possible. I don't think it's perfect, but I will say it's certainly one of the better Stephen King movies that we've done since we started this undertaking. And it's also one of the better, just in hearing what the book is versus the movie. I think it's one of the stronger adaptations as far as a change standpoint. You know, I talked a lot about Dr. Sleep being like that in that regard, where I haven't read the book, but having heard it, I like what they did with the movie more as a follow-up to the Kubrick film than just a straight adaptation of that book. My only complaints are, I just think there's some narrative inclusions for forced drama that are not needed. And like I said, I think it gets a little simplistic with how it depicts the villain, but top-notch performances across the board. I don't know if I'm ever going to watch this again willingly for the sake of enjoyment. Certainly if I'm doing like analysis down the road or things like that, I'll revisit it. But all in all, very, very strong effort. I'm going to go 8 as well.
Well, you wouldn't have your surroundings that you watch this the first time if you were to watch it a second time. So maybe that can give you some gumption to watch it again. All right. I'm going to probably alienate some people during this summarization, but just kind of stay with me. Earlier in the year, there was a movie called Sinners, and I was told by critics, I was told by friends that you need to see this. It's going to be the best movie of the year. I saw it and I found it to be okay. I thought the first half was great. I thought the second half kind of let me down. So going into this, even though I'm the King fan of this podcast and I was looking forward to seeing what they could do, there was some great advance buzz. And I came in a little trepidatious, especially given how angry I was that it took me much longer than I expected to see this fucking movie. I had to wait another day. So when I sat down, I wasn't sure exactly what to expect, even though I had read that book and quite enjoyed it. This far exceeded my expectations, given that I wasn't a huge fan of Strange Darlings. Hunger Games movies went back and forth with me. I do think Francis Lawrence has some talent behind the camera, but I wasn't sure if he was the one who could handle the narrative that, Adam, you outlined beautifully, and that this is just people walking and talking for the most part. How are you going to handle that suspense? But I think the horror behind this is what makes it work. Those shots, man, they linger, and it hurts every single time we see someone get shot in this. And we have mentioned, we're not going to see this in too many of these King retrospective reviews, but we've mentioned the O word a few times in this podcast, and I'm going to say it again. I think David Johnson deserves an Oscar nomination for what he pulls off here. I think he is tremendous. He is a bright light in a very, very dark film, and this movie is tremendous to me. I would say when we get done, we're going to have a podcast where we run down these King adaptations in order. I would not be shocked if this is in my top 5, maybe even top 3 of King adaptations. I'm giving this a solid 9. I watched it twice just to reinforce whether I was going to give it that 9, because that is a high score, especially for a Stephen King adaptation. But I think what J.T. Mulner and Francis Lawrence and this whole cast do is tremendous. There is not one weak link in this cast. I would say Mark Hamill a little bit, but that's only because of what Hamill has established his entire career. Still, I think the major works in this movie. I think this movie works as a whole, and it is one of those movies that you only need to see once. I agree with Matt on that. It is a tough watch, but if you're in the mood and there are dark things going on in this world right now, I think there are worse things to watch than The Long Walk. So I'm going to give this a solid 9 out of 10. Guys, before this movie started, I saw a trailer for another King adaptation that we're going to be covering, The Running Man. If we're not going to give our anticipatory thoughts when we are running our other retrospective reviews, let's talk about that right now. I gotta say, guys, I was not too impressed with that trailer. I hope Wright can pull this off, but I'm having some second thoughts. Matt, what are you feeling going into The Running Man coming up?
Edgar Wright's not going to be someone I doubt until I watch a movie of his I dislike. Now, that happened with Last Night in Soho, but I walked into that movie with the best of confidence. And I'm doing the same for this. I like that they're taking a different approach to the Schwarzenegger movie. I think that was the right call to make if you're going to do this in the first place. And I have confidence. If it's bad, I'll be surprised. But I appreciate they're taking this in a different direction. I like the cast too much to be anything but concerned.
You didn't like Last Night in Soho?
No, I thought it was great to look at. But I thought as an Edgar Wright movie, it got a little too far up its own ass.
Interesting.
And I thought that the big twist at the end was so freaking obvious, and everyone pretended they were shocked by it.
I would look forward to reviewing that with you. I have different thoughts, but I haven't seen it since it was released in theaters.
Yeah, well, you like it because it's got big eyes in it.
That does raise my score a couple points. You're right. Adam, my good friend, The Running Man coming up. What are you expecting? Do you have good thoughts coming into it?
I don't want to go watch Last Night in Soho because I enjoyed that film.
Thank you.
You know what? I want to. The trailers, I don't think have been good. I think the trailer's been inconsistent, and I just don't think they've given me, let me know what tone the movie is. I'm hopeful, because much like Matt, like, I think the cast is good. I think you got to go a different way. I think the time is right for telling this type of story, even though we just got The Long Walk, which is kind of in that, you know, realm. And God knows The Hunger Games is never fucking ending, because they're going to just keep a new movie and a new book every year, it seems.
Gotta do that one next year.
Yep, but I don't know. The trailers, I've not been a fan of. But much like Matt, and Edgar Wright, name on it, excites me more than anything else. So until he disappoints me multiple times, I'm going to be there. And I'm glad I can see it in the theater. Glenn Powell, whatever. But I do think the time is right to do a good adaptation of this. Not that the original wasn't fantastic, but to do something a little more true to the prose, I think could be good. So I'm hopeful, but we'll see.
Thank you guys for joining me on this special Halloween edition of the Three Men in Retrospective podcast. Stay tuned. We're going to have our Running Man review coming up, as well as, of course, we have Jaws. And, well, I'll save what we're going to be doing after Jaws until that final Jaws Revenge podcast. So stay tuned. Lots of good things to end the year. Maybe even a little Marvel coming up. But until next week, when we continue our Jaws retrospective, guys, just podcast with me a little longer. Thank you, boys.
Keep your head up, buddy. You gave this your all.
Did?
Yeah.
Did.
Like, fuck, you did.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Just keep walking a little longer, okay?
No, okay. Okay.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
And I'd like to end this shit with my head held high.
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including the Planet of the Apes franchise, Star Wars,
the ongoing Marvel series, the Alien franchise,
the Mad Max movies, movies featuring the team-up of Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, Jurassic Park,
the Exorcist films,
as well as solo reviews for films like The Black Phone, Megan, and so many more.
Pretty fucking desolate.
Oh shit.
Thought there'd be more people, I guess.
A Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
Big boy's gonna have no problem walking an hour without getting another warning.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
Fucking hate that fucking guy.
Yeah, me too.
Scheduling done by Matt.
Thanks. Thanks, both of y'all. Of course.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
This one wants to make the world a better place.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
No harm in keeping each other amused.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
We're all in this together, right?
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2025, and any and all sound and audio clips are used for entertainment purposes only.
Come on, man. Let's be musketeers.
How the fuck are we gonna be musketeers? There's four of us.
Come on now. We stick together to where all that stuff. How about that? All for one!
One for all.
And again, I need to hear it louder. All for one!
And one for all!
Hell yeah!
Yeah, right, you know.
Warning.
Adam, as somebody who just watched this movie, how do you think that gimmick would have worked, putting GoPros on the walkers as they walk?
I think it's funny. You keep saying walkers and George A. Romero, and all I think is The Walking Dead.
That's funny.
Like Dan Frank Darabont, who did The Walking Dead.
Exactly. Like Robert Kirkman is jerking off in a corner now trying to count his money. I think you could have... Because imagine if you trip, sprain an ankle. I mean, imagine if you're... never mind. I'm not going to make a comment about certain sport teams. But what it's like just rolling an ankle. Look, I'm reading 1984 right now, so think, speak, and being dragged out of a home. I mean, it is so literal translation of that book that all you did was literally exactly that. For talking about your government, you're going to get dragged. So I get it for the story. It almost would have been more effective just to have them disappear and not be resolved by the end of it.
Boy, 1984, I don't know if I could read that book now. We read it in high school.
I never read it till just now, and I actually stopped about 2 weeks ago and started reading Harry Potter for the first time because I needed a fucking break.
Pete says,
final warning.
I came up with the perfect analogy. This is the exact same problem I have with Sam Raimi's movie, The Quick and the Dead, it's a horrible institution that's put on by... this town with the dueling competition. And then you find out, oh, Sharon Stone's just doing this because she wants revenge for Gene Hackman killing her father. So it's, you're going after the person, not the institution. It's the same problem I have with that.
Adam, didn't you and I see Quick and the Dead in the theater? I think we did.
Sure did.
Yeah.
And I think we rented it when it came on video.
We did.
Yeah. And you watch that movie, you go, oh, this DiCaprio kid's not going anywhere.
Right. Yeah, he's not good in that movie at all.
Is that the kid from Family Ties? What the... Yeah.
Ray also
so fucked. This thing is so fucked. It's all so fucked.